Today and tomorrow, I'd like to talk about what we mean with long live the mission. And today, I would like to give you a thumbnail sketch of five people, whom I know and who represent what I think is what is really happening in the mission of the church throughout the world. Now, when I do that, I guess I always have to say, I'm not trying to have a hagiology, a story of the modern saints. Everybody's got his problems and weaknesses, and these are people that I see with a certain sense of vision. And the vision that they have represented is very important. Tomorrow, I want to speak about every man in today's mission. And there, I guess I'd really like to have the rubber hit the road. What is it that we, over here in a country like the United States, can do in order to be involved in the broader mission of the church? And that is within the United States and throughout the world. And that's going to be some maybe basic thesis. At the end of the last session, I spoke about what I felt was pretty well the decay of the older understanding of mission, namely that the churches in America and Europe were sending people over to the countries of the third world, of Asia, Africa, the South Pacific, and the Near East, in order to reproduce in some way or other the Christian church, and often that Christian church was in the form that it went out of the United States or Europe or whatever the source might be. I should have included, of course, Latin America in those places where the church was planted. A good deal of the decline of that mission came through the two world wars, particularly the Second World War, when a great number of missions were made. The older way of running the mission simply became impossible. Not only were all the Axis missionaries, that is, Germans and Italians, repatriated and moved out of the areas, but even among the countries connected with the Allies, transportation, moving over into the fields like that was so difficult that there was an effective moratorium in many respects, and the church began to stand on its own feet. Well, there was an interesting debate that took place in 1938, and it says a couple things that I think are very important. 1938 was the date of the International Missionary Council, which met in a little town outside of Madras, India, called Tambaram. And there were two main issues raised at that point. There are a lot of other stuff. But basically, a man by the name of Hocking brought out what was called the Layman's Report. Put very briefly, the layman's report was a criticism of all the mission and mission work that had been going on in the past, and they said, we recommend that henceforth missions simply try to help the Hindu become a better Hindu, the Buddhist become a better Buddhist, the Muslim become a better Muslim, and we should give whatever help we can toward healing the sick, toward education, toward economic help, toward social help, all things of this nature. The gospel, after all, isn't our private province. The gospel really has come in these other religions as well, and as we see the gospel there, we should affirm it, and we should let them develop it in their own ways. In effect, it was questioning the distinctiveness of the Christian message. That report actually came out in 1937, And then, that time, quite a young man, a layman by the name of Hendrik Kramer, a Dutchman who had worked in Indonesia for some years, prepared the main statement for this International Missionary Council, and that was later published under the title of A Christian the Christian Message in the Non-Christian World. And Hendrik Kramer said, no. He said, the Christian message is basically a distinctive message from other religions. In fact, I think Hendrik Kramer would come very close to saying that Christianity is not a religion. Christianity is the faith. The others are religions. Now, Christianity has often become a religion, but in that respect, it becomes as demonic as the other religions. The distinctive of the Christian faith that God in history broke into history in Jesus Christ and assumed unto himself all the sin and wickedness of the world and redeemed the world to himself, brought the world back to himself, reconciled the world to himself. That fact of what God did is the great distinctive. Now, the theory that God could forgive sins and things like this, there's nothing distinctive about that. But that God actually did it in history, that's the real distinctive. And people who are outside of this cannot understand it. Now, that would, at first glance, make us think that what Kramer is saying is there's really no possibility of bringing the gospel to other people because they can't understand it anyway. But his conclusions are radically different. His conclusions are that what we ought to do is to continue to witness to that gospel and to live that gospel and do many of the things which the other report said, to go out and preach the to heal the sick, to work toward economic betterment, to work on social issues, things like this, but continually as a witness of our commitment to Jesus Christ, in whom God reconciled the world to himself. Now, these were issues that really came like that against each other at that time, and there was a good deal of development there that I don't want to go into. However, the important thing that now develops is that people begin to catch this vision. And we have in the third world, and by the third world I'm speaking of Asia, Africa, Latin America, the South Pacific, the Near East, and the Caribbean, those places where Christianity came as sort of a second religion. Now, I know I'm not completely accurate there, because it certainly has been in the Near East a long time, and in parts of India and Asia it has been a long time. But that's this is a general term. In the third world, there are people who have caught a vision like this. Five people I would like to speak about are a man called Samuel Amirtham, A-M-I-R-T-H-A-M. Amirtham is the way it's often pronounced. Proper pronunciation is Amirtham. The second one is S. Suvi Seshavuttu, who even in India is called Suvi, because even that long name doesn't go that easily. Suvi Seshavuttu means Pearl of the Gospel. The third one is F. Ross Kinsler, who is a man who has worked in the third world, but is a good example, I believe, of a missionary who has caught this vision. The fourth one is Joseph D'Angienda, who is the spiritual head of the Church of Jesus Christ on earth, according to Simon Kimbangu, his prophet, and is the son of Simon Kimbangu. This is an independent church in Zaire, in Africa. And the fifth person is a lady, Marie-Louise Martin, a Swiss lady who has been the publicist and is working in that independent church. First Samuel Amirtham. In many respects, Samuel Amirtham ought to be a Brown missionary. That is, Samuel Amirtham's training has been so greatly influenced by missionaries and by the old style of missionary understanding, the mission that was dead, that if you would talk about his training, Samuel Amirtham should be a Westerner in dark skin. For Samuel Amirtham grew up very close to where we lived. In fact, Nehemiah, whom many of all of you have seen and many of you have met, Nehemiah was the pastor for 2.5 years, was the pastor of the church where Samuel Amirtham grew up. Samuel Amirtham went through Scott Christian College, which was at that time, I think through Scott Christian College, which at that time was run by missionaries. He went through Bangalore United Theological College, where there were Indian professors, but many missionary professors. And he went to Germany, and at Hamburg, he got his doctorate in Old Testament under Krauss, did you say?
Hans-Joachim
Krauss, a recognized scholar, Old Testament scholar, and wrote his doctorate upon on the subject of the meaning of the royal psalms, which I dare say many people would say, what has that to do with South India? But Samuel Amirtham is a man with, and this is the word that I find so very important, a word with a man with immense sensitivity. Samuel Amirtham returned, became the principal of a theological college about 150 miles away from where we worked, and had all the competencies which are required. I have heard him teach and have been amazed and have almost said, I even said to him, why are you the principal of this college when you can teach like that? I have seen the way he administers his situation. But a man who realized that the mission is something that has to grow up in that area itself. Two examples of the things in which he has been a leader. He has that feel for the constituency that he always knows how far to go without disenchanting his constituency. One example is that in their church, in the chapel of the seminary, they have some bronze pictures, bas relief, I guess, where you hammer the bronze out, is that what you call it? You know, brass hammered out. They are figures of Jesus in his passion, in his resurrection, Jesus with Mary and Martha, and a fourth one, at the ascension. And at first glance, you say, well, what's so different about that? He has it done completely within the concept of Hinduism. Jesus looks like the god Krishna. Jesus sits with his legs folded like this, and in the what to us seems a very effeminate style of holding his scepter in a way like this. And the women, Mary and Martha, are not the modestly garbed, with medieval garb, incidentally, women that we know, but rather buxom, full-bosomed ladies who are sitting on either, one sitting and the other standing on the other side of him. And when this took place, and when he brought this out the first time, he evidently had enough of an ear for that to realize that the place was just going to blow to pieces for the time being. This is paganism. You are reintroducing Hinduism. But he simply would smile and go along with it and realize that this was a step that had to be taken, and continually moves forward in order that The person who comes from outside the Christian faith can say, now there is a Jesus that I understand. The second thing was that when his sabbatical came, Samuel Amritam decided that what he and his wife would do was to move out of the rather comfortable bungalow residence in which he in which they were living, and move into a slum section of that very town, I don't think more than 4 or 5 miles away, and to become identified with that community. For he had been encouraging students to do this for a long time. He had gotten support for them to live in areas like that, and he had been needling more and more of them to do it. And in his sensitivity, he probably realized, unless I put myself in that same position, I'm just going to be preaching. I am not going to be showing that sort of an understanding of the gospel. Samuel Amritam, for this reason, is a person who is widely respected in the Hindu community. They see that here is a man who is deeply interested in them. They are not going to have a person who argues with them, but still a man who is, as Hendrik Kramer would want it to be, a man who is deeply committed to his Lord Jesus Christ. This is part of the new mission. S. Suvisesha Muttu is a former student of mine and later a colleague at the seminary. Suvi is a maverick and always has been a maverick. In fact, one reason he came to the seminary there was that he was such a maverick in high school that the missionary with whom he was connected recommended that he should not be sent to college. He came from a very poor family because he really wasn't the sort of obedient type of person that you would want to send to college and to become influential in the church. And if he had gone to college, I am sure that Suvi would have gotten into some very lucrative position because he's a man of immense capability. So he went through a teacher's training college, and then he came to the seminary, and he studied under people like me and Dr. Martin Kretzmann, who I hear will probably be here in February. However, he always retained a very great degree of his Indianness and was always ready to be very critical. A good example of this critical and Indian attitude was that when he came onto the faculty, I said to him, I had been his professor, and I could always say that. I said, Suvi, now that you and I are on the faculty together, why don't you call me Herb? Well, he said, sir, I can't do that. I said, but you're free to. I'm not asking you to do it. He said, I know that. But he said, if I call you Herb in a private capacity, and even in the faculty meeting, it might be all right. But if I would ever slip and call you sir in front of other people, the implication would be that I no longer have any respect for my guru, my teacher, and therefore I cannot call you sir, her, sir. And always, even to the present day, he would say, well, when he came over here, I guess he didn't call me sir, but in India, I would always be sir to him. And yet, at the same time, Suvi is the sort of person that could say, you are nuts, sir. The ability to stand up and say, I don't agree with what you are saying. And so he also has begun to probe into new directions. After teaching at the seminary for about 3 years, he then was asked to head up a group called Christian Arts and Communication Service. This has been connected with Bringing Christ to the Nations, which is the overseas arm of the Lutheran Hour, and has been far more adventurous in probing new ways of communication than the Lutheran Hour here in the United States has been. And among the things that he has developed was a dance drama depicting the effect of Christ upon the Christian, the Christ upon the life of an individual. And he too had to go through a great deal of difficulty, because the only people who really dance well in the Bharatanatyam, the South Indian dance style, are Hindus, because they learn it from the time they're little girls or little boys. And so he had to hire Hindus. He did get, well, what happened often was that he hired Hindus, and some of these, after being under the impact of the drama, became Christians, but their whole background was Hindu. And so he developed this dance drama, not he himself, he enabled other people to do it. And as that developed, he came under tremendous fire. He told me of one of his colleagues who said, "I will have nothing to do with this whatsoever." This was when it was in the rehearsal stage. And he told me that he said, "All right, there's only one thing I ask you, come to the rehearsal tomorrow night." And he said that by the end of that rehearsal, the man was in tears, because he suddenly realized that by using a Hindu form, a form that was basically used for the praise of the innumerable gods of the Hindu pantheon, and using this in order to describe what Jesus meant to people, that this had a could have a tremendous impact. And that's just what it did. But if he had waited for everyone to, had sat down and asked people, "What do you think about it? Do you think I should try it?" he wouldn't ever have gotten this thing moving. And that's the sort of a spirit that is going on in the church over in India. Both of these men now, coming out of traditions, one very Western tradition, but still understanding his Indian roots, the other one being a maverick, and while having some influence from people like me and Martin Kretzmann and others, still a very Indian person, but continually plugged into the rest of the community. The third person is a man from Guatemala. He's what I have, he was a Mish kid. You know what Mish, you know what PKs are. Preacher's kids. Well, Mish kids are missionaries' kids. His father was a missionary in Korea of a Presbyterian church, an extremely fundamentalist group there. Ross Kinsler is his name. Ross Kinsler came to Guatemala and began teaching at a seminary in San Felipe Roy in the about 120 miles from Guatemala City. When he and his colleagues had been teaching there for a certain length of time, they decided to make a study of what was happening with the graduates of their seminary. Now, San Felipe is a village place. It is way outside of the area of the of Guatemala City, which is the really Hispanicized, the Spanish part of Guatemala. In that place, even in that place, they found that they were training young people to become pastors of the church, people who, with that education they had, would move to Guatemala City, get themselves a job because they had some other competencies as well, and then wait for the next Guatemala City pastor to retire or die, and then vie for that position. The congregations in the boondocks were not receiving anything at all. And so, with what I would consider to be a tremendous act of faith, they immediately closed down the seminary as a residential institution and opened it as a theological education by extension institution. In effect, they decided that they would bring the seminary to the students instead of bringing the students to the seminary. This worked in three ways. One, And I visited with Ross Kinstler in this. He then lived in the city of Guatemala. He would go out in an evening and gather a group of people in some church building and teach them. Now, I don't understand Spanish, but I do know enough about the background. He was teaching the book of Romans, and it was absolutely fascinating to see how, with a few leading remarks, he didn't say anything, but the discussion was coming from various people, and he would be fielding the discussion and bringing things together. The second way in which to do it was that they still used the residential seminary and brought farmers in from their fincas or farms. One day a week, they would study and then spend the rest of the week in their farms, preparing as they could, and return just one day a week. And the third way was that he or one of his colleagues would be traveling around the countryside on a Saturday and a Sunday and conducting classes for the people in the place where they were. And the great thing that was happening was that where beforehand they had a lot of unemployed pastors because no pastors wanted to go into the boondocks, now the people who were chosen already as the natural leaders of the community were chosen and trained, and ministry was going on in the place where it had to be. And the ministry, again, was not simply a ministry of technical theology, but was reaching out on the basis of biblical study into all the avenues of life. Ross Kinstler, a man who came from Korea, grew up in the United States, has his doctorate from Edinburgh, Scotland, in New Testament, and is that sort of a fertile mind for that type of thing. He is now with the World Council of Churches in its program on theological education. Joseph D'Angienda is the chef spirituel, the spiritual head of the Church of Jesus Christ on Earth, according to Simon Kimbangu, his prophet. This is a church of somewhere between 2 and 4 million people. When you deal with the independent churches in Africa, you've got to deal with figures something like that. In 1923, Joseph's father, Simon Kimbangu, received a vision telling him that he should preach the gospel. He refused to hear that vision for 2 times, and on the third he started preaching. And after only 11 months of preaching, he was put into prison by the Belgian authorities at that time, condemned to death, and finally had that condemnation commuted to life imprisonment, and remained in prison for the rest of his life. The followers of Simon Kimbangu then went underground, and they allied themselves with anything but the Roman Catholic Church, against which they were a revolt, largely, but allied themselves, among other things, with the Salvation Army. Finally, in 1952, the Belgian authorities lifted the restrictions, not on Simon Kimbangu, but upon the worship of the people of the Kimbanguist Church, as it is known, and they then regrouped. The Salvation Army lost a great number of members very rapidly at that time. They regrouped, and that church is now somewhere between 2 and 4 million. It is distinctive in that it covers several tribes. I attended a service there of 5 hours in length with time out for lunch, thank goodness. I received a translation. It had to be from Kikongo or another language into French to another person who translated from French to English with me. I spoke with Joseph D'Angienda and was in his place, in his office, and on 2 occasions. I could not, he speaks only French or Kikongo, and I don't speak French or Kikongo. An interpreter was there all the time. Now, in one respect, if you would see this and see many of the things that happen, you would wonder, What sort of a situation is this? Joseph comes to a place and people will immediately bow down on their knees and they will ask him things. He walks into a place, everyone is on his knees. And when he comes up to someone, he immediately lifts that person up. He's a powerful man, 5 feet 8 inches tall and perhaps 185, 200 pounds, not fat, just solid muscle. He lifts these people up and asks them what they want. He gives them healing, but always under the understanding that the healing comes from God. Joseph was chosen out of 3 brothers. Toward the end of his life, Simon Kimbangu called his 3 sons into the prison, and he said, "Joseph, you are my successor." And Joseph was the youngest of the 3. Today, whenever they make any decision for the church, and it's a very autocratic church in many respects, the 3 brothers go into seclusion, and they pray about anything that they are about to do. And yet, they have realized that they have a vision of where they want to go. They have laid upon their people that they must be pacifists. The members of the Kimbanguist church will not join the army as soldiers. They are happy to join the armies as hewers of wood, drawers of water, and medical orderlies. They have a tremendous musical sense. I've never seen this, that a whole wedge of the congregation suddenly gets up and sings in parts music which has been composed by the people right there without any training other than what has been handed down from father to son and mother to daughter. They have many restrictions on meat. They do not smoke. And yet they have a reputation within the community that when these people come in to go to their seminary, they have to support themselves completely. They are hired almost like that by the hotels in town as treasurers, as they speak, as the financial people there, because in the eyes of most of the Zairians, the Kimbanguists are the only people that you can really trust with money. All of this is in the idea of Joseph de Anchieta. He has led the people in this direction, and when I visited him, he immediately began to ask me about the things where I came from, would answer my questions. And as I left on that day, my hostess, whom I will speak about shortly, said, "You must say goodbye to the chef spirituel." And I walked into his office. The 3 of us were there. She translated. He wished me a good voyage, and then he said, "We will now kneel and pray." And then we all knelt on the ground, and he prayed. Prayer, as it was later translated to me, with a great deal of evidence that he had been listening to the sort of things in which we were interested, that he had a vision of where the church ought to go, and that he was willing to put himself on the line for that kind of thing. A man with no roots in the West whatsoever, a man about whose a theological stance we would have a lot of questions, but a man about whose commitment to the Lord Jesus Christ one can say nothing but amen. And the final person about whom I want to speak is Marie-Louise Martin. She was my hostess here. Marie-Louise Martin had worked in Lesotho, which is one of the sections, the enclaves in South Africa, and in South Africa, but had made herself finally a persona non grata in South Africa and had been told to leave. She was asked then to make a survey of this particular church because it was applying for membership in the World Council of Churches. And some question arose about its essentially Christian nature. She made this survey. In effect, she was converted, and now she has returned there and conducts theological education for people there, right on site. It's a fascinating thing. Ralph, can you imagine this? She and her colleagues, some other Swiss colleagues, teach two identical courses every day. Identical classes. And the reason is that the students all have to support themselves. Some of them have night duty, some of them have morning duty. And a man may have morning duty on one day and night duty the next day, so you can never be sure that the two classes are the same. But you will know that in the morning or the evening class, all the students will come. So each of the classes is repeated. And a great deal of their church life shows through. I was very much amused when she introduced me. She said, and this is all going on in French, we wish to welcome Dr. Zorn in the name of the Father, and of the Son, and of the Holy Spirit. So whenever you're welcomed, you get three applauses, and they're between the Father and the Son and the Holy Spirit. And at the end of one of the classes, these students all got up, and one of the students got up, and they began to they had a project for which they would give money. And they had a list of the rows of the students. There were about three rows of students. And then before long, who will give this? All right, I will give that much, one Zaire, one of the Zairean dollars. I will give so much, and then they'd mark it, and someone say, I'll give three. All of a sudden, there'd be a great deal of clapping. Their contribution to the church is a public thing. One of the things in this big church service that I had, that I attended, Father Joseph, Papa, as he is called, Joseph D'Angienda, sat in almost on a throne. His wife, a buxom lady, sat right next to him. And in front of that, there was one of these huge porcelain dishes. And the congregations would go by, and they would practically dance by. And then as they came there, they'd go throw in their money, and everybody would clap, including the people who were giving this money. It was a joyful thing. And finally, at the end, all of this was being recorded by treasurers, and at the end of the day, the championship for today has been won by the congregation in such and such a part. And all of a sudden, everybody would clap, and then, you know, the second place and all of those would be mentioned. A joyful way in which the gospel is being proclaimed. And I guess the thing that I see in all of these people, Samuel Amedam, the man with the Western background and an Indian mind and thought, Suvisesha Muttu, the man with his very deep Indianness and yet his understanding of what the people need, Joseph D'Angienda reaching out not only to his own people but also to the broader community, World Council of Churches, even though he's practically the only independent church so connected, and Marie-Louise Martin turning her back on South Africa where she couldn't go back anymore and becoming completely identified with this church. The word I see in all of them is this deep sensitivity. A sensitivity that when based in my understanding of Jesus Christ, I am utterly free to be what I can be in order that Christ may reign. Now, these are sort of the things that are coming into the understanding of the mission of the church today. And that's where, well, tomorrow I want to talk about it, but that's where we have to join in that sensitivity. Or we're moving back into the old ideas. Other questions or comments?
At the beginning, you made a distinction between Christianity as a faith and other religions. And listening to the examples you give and the way in which Christianity has been allowed to be expressed in various sorts of forms, I'm wondering if what you're suggesting, that the life of the mission now is to encourage that the faith find modes of expression in various religious forms. Is that going too far?
No.
For example, I mean, the Hindu looking bronze relief with Jesus and Mother Mary, for example.
No, I would agree with that. In fact, that particular example is far less radical than some other people would suggest. Mm-hmm. You see, there are people who are suggesting that for Christians, for the Judeo-Christians, the Old Testament is fine. But if you're talking about a Muslim, you should permit their Old Testament to be the Quran. You should permit the Hindus to use the Vedic books as their Old Testament. Now that is not where I would be going, because of my conviction that in Scripture we are dealing with a unity. Mm-hmm. But that the Christian faith should be open to receive, to be expressed in the forms of the community.
Well, my next question was going to be, if you take this first step, doesn't it almost automatically lead to the second step? It seems to me that there's some necessary connection between the form and the content, if by form we mean religious form of expression, content then the faith, that one can't simply insert any content into any form, that there has to be a mutual receptivity. But that if you make this assertion, then you're inevitably going to invite other contents, and you're going to call for something like the in some part of the world, the canonization of the Quran as something equivalent to the Old Testament, or perhaps displacing the Old Testament, or whatever. So how do you come down in order to prevent that kind of amendment of the content?
Okay. I'd like to answer that in two ways. First of all, I would submit that what we have here in America is a very... We have an American Christianity. You were speaking about that yesterday. An American Christianity in which the content has been very drastically affected by the form.
I agree with you.
I don't see any way of avoiding this except this great confidence in the historical action, the fact that Jesus Christ really happened in history. That's where I'm coming down all the time. I grew up in a tradition which said that Christian religion, that the religions of the world are divided into two categories, the category of works and the categories of faith. And there is only one in the category of faith, of grace, and that's the Christian religion. Well, that, frankly, is hogwash, because you find grace, maybe not in our definition, but you find grace in Islam, you find grace in Hinduism, you find grace in many different faiths. But the one point at which people see the distinctiveness is when we say, if you, Hindu, who follow Krishna, does it really make any difference to you whether the story about Krishna and the milkmaids, or Krishna swallowing such and such a serpent and rescuing an entire village, does it make any difference to you whether that happened or whether it is myth? And they will say, no, it makes no difference, because the truth still remains there. And on the contrary, if someone asks me, does it make any difference to you whether Jesus of Nazareth really came into the world and lived among people and taught and suffered and died? And to that I must say, it makes all the difference in the world. And I think that becomes the purgative, if that's what we're, the corrective.
But then, in some sense, you would even want to say that the so-called sacred books of other world religions retain a certain kind of validity and perhaps can be read together as other kinds of perhaps even revelatory documents, provided one understands that the central meaning of God's action in history is the Christ event.
Right. I don't know whether it was in this group that I mentioned this business about Bishop Newbegin, who had been, did I mention this to you? Bishop Newbegin had once been challenged. He had spoken about the Christian faith, and a Hindu came up to him and said,
"You mentioned that in this group."
Yes. Yeah. Okay. Yeah, Ralph.
I guess I would like to say kind of what he's saying, maybe from a different angle, especially our study of Paul and the way in which Paul preaches what is really the center of his whole proclamation. The justification of Christ crucified, by means of when he comes to these pre-Pauline congregations and a form of Christianity which was a little different than his, and even to his own tradition, he will use it, and very often it seems to be contrary to really his main message. Let's say, for instance, the way in which he speaks in almost 2 Corinthians 5, the first part, of the body as not being worth anything, and almost a nasty matter, almost uncreaturely, and put off this thing like a tent, you know, folded up and then go. Doesn't seem to be the same way that he speaks about it in 1 Thessalonians, where he died Christ's death and rise with his resurrection, and or in 1 Corinthians 15. So he is carrying out a conversation in all these letters with various people, and he is becoming all things to all men, not in order to water it down, but in order to somehow take that risk of making them understand it. And now your big question is, what about the content? It really depends upon what you mean by the content, you see that?
Mm-hmm. And yeah, I take it that in some sense, the comprehension of the message of faith is a lot different than the understanding of some sort of objective, or at least in wholly objectifying language.
Yeah, well, I was taught in a really, really ultra-conservative Latin slugs of the old dogmaticians of the 17th and 18th century. In a lot of my theology, one thing I remember very distinctly, I was offended by at the time, I think it's great, the dogmatician, I think it was Hollis, I think, who simply said that though the Holy Scriptures are our norm and our source of the preaching of the gospel, the Holy Scriptures are not the source for the preaching of the law. You can learn that anywhere. Mm-hmm. So you could learn that sort of thing. It would still be the norm for the preaching of the law, but they wouldn't be necessarily the source. You might learn it, as we, I think, often do, from Aeschylus, or to me, Aeschylus and Agamemnon preaches the wrath of God in a way that is really gripping to any human being. And I think that Bultmann is really right in his famous essay on the significance of the Old Testament for Christian faith, when he simply says you can learn many of these things, even prophetic things as far as the law is concerned, elsewhere. You don't have to do that. So really, going back to my very ultra-conservative roots, I simply said, well, maybe those guys realize that, you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. So this opens up then to world religions. Now, it still does keep that one distinctive thing. And once you move that out of the center and you begin to point so much to the frame of reference, and the frame of reference takes over as perhaps Gnosticism or something like that, then what is what you call the content has been lost. Mm-hmm. And what you call the historical has been lost. But I think you have to take that risk. That's what teaching is, isn't it? You have to do that every day right here. It isn't just something you do in the mission field.
I'd like to challenge one thing. If we're saying, I certainly agree with this, that you can find law, often much more complete law, in non-Christian religions than you do in Christianity. But I think I'd like to add to it, I think you can find gospel in theory. The distinctive of the Christian faith is not specifically this, that God forgives sins. You find this you don't like to find it, but you can find this in Sufi. This is Muslim mystic literature. You can find it in Hinduism. But that God, a theory of a God who does forgive sins, but the fact that that God has actually done it, and in the process of self-giving, even the theory of self-giving you can find in Hindu mythology. Hindu mythology frequently will have the idea that a huge poisonous serpent comes into a village, and suddenly the god appears there and swallows the serpent and turns blue because of all the poison in him. But he saves the whole village. So at great sacrifice, and the god has appeared in the form of a man. So the theory can be there.
I understand. Yeah.
And so we affirm it.
No, I think it depends on what you mean by the content. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Has Christianity reached into the very remotest parts of Africa? Yes.
I guess yes and no. In fact, Christianity has not reached into the very remotest parts of India, even. I mean, there you can go back into the bush where people will know nothing about it. I'm sure that's true in Africa as well. But I do believe that there is a possibility for Christianity to reach into every part of the world. And I guess the other side of that is that I am convinced that the way Christianity must reach there is through the Christians of that land and of that area. And that's really what I want to get into tomorrow. What is the place for us now today to send missionaries overseas? I think I would like to urge that a missionary goes overseas always and exclusively as a invited helper to one of the churches there, with all the ambivalences and difficulties that are involved. Now, if it is true that there is a desert island, or a desert island, whether it's actually surrounded by water or whether it's inaccessible, where the gospel has never come, that's a different ball game. I don't want to underrate people like Elizabeth Elliot, something of splendor. You know, the Awka Indian, the widow of the man who was killed by the Awka Indians in Central America somewhere, through Gates of Splendor, I guess. People who went into areas like this and sacrificed for them. My respect for them is great. But I think that we are dealing in a new day. And if I walk into a country of Africa and sort of say to my African colleagues, sorry, you aren't doing the job, I'm the one that can do it, this is denying a fellowship. This is, I think maybe it's the older son in the prodigal son story again.
I guess my experience is very limited compared to yours, but the year that I spent in New Guinea really made me, however, respect, say, the Illinois Devil's Out Mission Society, and that old, well-trained, centuries-long wisdom that they had in sending out people, and where they made mistakes, let's say in Africa or similar places, that then they would try with some real ingenuity into Guinea, not to baptize their first converts for years and years and years, because the orders of creation were more important than the orders of salvation. And the respect that I would have for Johannes Clero and those people who went out, I don't know whether I could maybe agree with you there, that it must be, you know, I mean, you're absolute must. I don't know how far you're going to press that. Because in that case, these people simply had the command of the Lord, and they simply went out.
I'm speaking of our present, when I say must, I'm speaking of what I think ought to be done today. Mm-hmm. Not, certainly not, I believe that they were going to an area where the gospel had never come.
Don't we, I guess that's my question with what she's saying over there, don't we really have, are we that far removed from the old ways? And don't you have Christian Kaiser, this tremendous surge going far beyond what the native first generation Christians would have done. And he just pushed them beyond. And I think it had to take someone like that would, in a sense, be very radical. I mean, it was radical. And whether it would seem to me that the first generation Christian, at least, would not be able to do that. Now, you're talking more of a longer generation of Christians with more experience, native Christians, than me. Or aren't you? I mean, that's my problem.
Yeah. I guess the other part, the question, which I haven't gone into in any detail, the other question I would raise is, are you as ready to receive missionaries from the younger churches as we are to send them to the younger churches? Or are we going to be our patronizing selves and say, well, after all, we've been Christians for so many years?
No, I don't think I'd have a hang up on that. But I guess... maybe it's nostalgia, but let's just take an example. I don't know if you stopped there in Zambia. My bad.
No, I didn't get to say.
And I was really amazed when I went there to visit some of my former students and friends, how well Wisconsin Synod, with all its hang-ups, without a lot of missiology, was doing. A rather solid work.
Correct. And I will agree to this, that the Lord has an ability to change some of our gosh-awful foolishness into great things. I would, in the book, I think that was probably one of the great themes, the big theme in this book, Much Cause for Joy, that we could, there were a bunch of Germans, those first German missionaries used to spend all their conference time studying the implications of the Lutheran confessions for the German Missouri Synod controversies that were going on at that time. And, you know, some the patronizing stuff that went on. Henry Null, a man who of some saintly fame in the Missouri Synod, told me once, he said, you know, when we first conducted services in that place, we had the service, and then as people walked out, the women would take the end of their sari and make a little bag out of it, and we'd pour in grain for them, ragi, a kind of grain. And he said, if you didn't do it, no one would ever come to church. Well, you say, for goodness sake. But the children and the grandchildren of those people are the leaders of the church. I don't know the genealogy of Suvisesha Muttu, but he could very well be in that tradition.